The headlines, the White House says U.S. President Joe Biden supports normalization of relations between Israel and some Arab countries. Amnesty International says a detention of Dubai ruler's daughter amounts to torture. This after she emerged in a new video detailing her plight in captivity. Spanish police clash with protesters in Madrid and Barcelona during a second night of demonstrations against the arrest of a rapper over insulting the monarchy. Welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisoum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and U.S. President Joe Biden have held a telephone conversation for the first time since the American president came to office 4 weeks ago. A statement by the White House said the two announced that they would collaborate to continue strengthening the steadfast alliance between Israel and the U.S. Added that Biden emphasized the U.S. support for recent normalization of relations between Israel and some Arab countries. The statement noted that Biden and Netanyahu discussed the importance of continued close consultations on regional security issues, including Iran. The White House also said Biden told Netanyahu he intends to strengthen military cooperation with Israel. Political commentator Paul LaRudy says it is hard to imagine that any problem occurs in U.S.-Israel relationships.
Well, something's going on behind the scenes. We know that, for example, Obama had, difficult relations just before he left office. And Biden is not telling us why he's doing this. He's obviously doing this to make a point. And he certainly listens to advice from Obama. So something's going on that we can't be sure about. What we can be sure about is that the United States will pretty much always follow instructions and provide Israel with what it wants and supposedly needs and all this sort of thing. It's hard to imagine any problems that occur in the U.S.-Israel relationship that will actually obstruct anything.
A U.S.-led coalition convoy has reportedly come under attack in Dahikar Governorate in southern Iraq. Iraqi media say the convoy carrying logistical equipment was targeted by a booby trap bomb in Al-Nasiriya Expressway. U.S. forces and their supply convoys have increasingly come under attack in Iraq amid growing anti-American sentiments there. Anger mounted after the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and senior commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in January last year. Following the assassination, the Iraqi parliament passed a resolution calling on the government to end the presence of U.S. forces in the country. The United States has approved a nearly $200 million arms sales to Egypt amid reports of human rights violations in the Arab country. The U.S. State Department described Egypt as an important strategic partner in the Middle East, adding that the sale was a routine replenishment of naval missiles. Egyptian authorities on Sunday detained relatives of Egyptian-American human rights activist Mohammed Sultan, who was jailed for nearly 2 years before being released in 2015. The U.S. State Department said Washington is looking into reports of the detentions, adding that Washington takes seriously all allegations of arbitrary arrest or detention. An official from Human Rights Watch said the repression under the Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi should have already stopped Egypt from receiving U.S. arms. Political commentator Michael Springman says the arms sales to Egypt indicates that the Biden administration may admonish human rights violations, but in practice, nothing changes.
The justification, of course, is that, we have to support our strong non-NATO country in the region because it's a vital American interest and it's vital to the security interests of Egypt. Well, it just beggars the mind that Biden talks one thing and says another. The other amazing thing about all of this, of course, is that there are no fingerprints of anybody in the Biden administration on this arms deal. It's always the Biden administration did it. It isn't that the Secretary of State had a hand in it, Anthony Blinken. It isn't that someone from the Central Intelligence Agency had a finger on it. It isn't that someone from the Agency for International Development had a finger on it. It's just the Biden administration, and no one owns up to having done this. And they're hopefully waiting for congressional approval. And I hardly think that the Democrats in Congress who are so beholden to Biden, another Democrat, will naysay this transfer of some $200 million worth of missiles for use in anti-ship activities in the Persian Gulf, not the Persian Gulf, I'm sorry, the Red Sea.
A new video has emerged from the missing daughter of Dubai's powerful ruler, in which she says she has been held hostage and fears for her life. Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum is now under pressure from the international community, but not so much from the one that the UAE's closest Western allies, the United Kingdom, which has been involved in the Sheikh scandals.
The family of Dubai's billionaire ruler, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, has once again made headlines. Back in 2018, the Sheikh's daughter, Sheikh Al Latifa, posted a video of herself just before making an abortive attempt to flee Dubai.
All my father cares about is his reputation. He will kill people to protect his own reputation. He only cares about himself and his ego. So this video could save my life.
In a new video published by the BBC, Latifa says on the last leg of her escape to India that her boat was intercepted and she was beaten, injected with a tranquilizer, and dragged back to Dubai.
I'm a hostage, and this villa has been converted into a jail. All the windows are barred shut. I can't open any window. I've been by myself, solitary confinement. No access to medical help. No trial, no charge, nothing.
But the Sheikh has denied the charges against him, describing his daughter's return to Dubai as a successful rescue operation. He insists she is now safe and in perfect health, but has yet to provide any evidence. Latifa's story is considered to be the latest in a series of scandals the Sheikh is grappling with. In March 2020, the UK's High Court found Sheikh Maktoum guilty of waging a campaign of fear and intimidation against Princess Haya, the youngest of Sheikh's six wives, and abducting her two adult daughters, Princess Latifa and Princess Shamsa, who was snatched off the streets of the city of Cambridge in England. It is said that Tony Blair's Labour government dropped a criminal inquiry into Shamsa's abduction as a diplomatic favour to the Sheikh. And it seems those favours keep coming, as the UK is still reluctant to condemn the billionaire.
I think it is concerning. We always raise human rights issues with all of our partners, including the UAE. There's no particular British locus in this case, but we are concerned by this.
But the statement appears to be far from the truth, as London heavily supports a deadly military campaign waged by the UAE and Saudi Arabia on Yemen. The country, the United Nations says, is facing the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. The new video of Sheikh Al Latifa has escalated international pressure on the UAE. Amnesty International expressed concern about Latifa's well-being, saying her detention amounts to torture. It also added that this case brings into light the other human rights violations for which the UAE has repeatedly come under fire. The UN also said it will discuss the matter with the UAE, noting that the international body could launch a thorough investigation into Latifa's fate.
clashes have broken out between Spanish security forces and protesters angry at the arrest of a rapper on charges of glorifying terrorism and insulting the monarchy. Protests in Madrid were initially peaceful, but police charged into the crowd wielding batons after a few protesters set fire to containers and began throwing glass bottles and stones. In Barcelona, police fired rubber bullets into the crowd. Catalan police said several people were detained following 18 arrests made during a heavy clash a night earlier. Tuesday night's unrest left 55 people injured, including 25 police officers. Pablo Hasél had posted a series of tweets calling former King Juan Carlos a mafia boss and accusing police of torturing and killing demonstrators and migrants. Earlier, we were joined by Cusay Kadri, our correspondent in Barcelona. He says Pablo Hasél's sentences widely seen as disproportionate and an abuse of the legal system.
Spain has had a troubled history, at least the Spanish justice had had a troubled history with singers and artists, just for the sake of respecting the penal code and not insulting the monarchy or the state institution. Pablo Hasél is one of those artists. He is a rapper. He's been singing with lyrics that tend to be quite acid and aggressive towards the Spanish monarchy, the justice, and the far right. He's been sentenced to 9 months, but he refused to hand himself over to the authorities, forcing the police, the Catalan police, to go and fetch him at university and conduct him to jail to serve his sentence. His sentence has been widely regarded by general consensus as disproportionate, because the Spanish legal system or the penal code does have these clauses where you cannot insult the king, you cannot insult the state institutions because they are sacrosanct. The end of the story is that his supporters and many across the northeastern region of Catalonia did regard this as yet another abuse of the legal system, leading to these protests that you've seen yesterday, today, and many which are scheduled to happen in the coming days.
The European Commission has launched a new strategy designed to combat the new mutations of the coronavirus. The move comes amid mounting criticism of the bloc's slow vaccination program. Jerome Hughes reports.
The latest available data suggests only 4.8% of EU citizens have so far been vaccinated against COVID-19. Frustration levels are growing because it is not yet clear when people living in the 27-nation bloc can expect to receive the jab.
Of course, everybody needs to speed up. All the countries, France, Belgium, Germany, it's all hanging. We're all hanging around and just waiting.
For example, in France, for my grandparents, it's quite hard to get some appointments to have a dose.
We should speed up a little more and start vaccination a lot. Vaccinate people a lot.
In hindsight, it turned out a bad decision that the EU was responsible, because the overall administration is so complex, it would have been easier to have this set up on a national level.
That widely held opinion is being rejected by the head of the European Commission.
With the purchasing power of 27, we were able to agree on this enormous volume I've just described, 2.3 billion doses.
So where are these doses? Experts say the reason the UK and US are way ahead of the EU on vaccination is because the European Commission was too slow to sign contracts with producers, and approval to use the jabs is also a sluggish process.
Mass vaccination centres like this one in Brussels are popping up right across the European Union. On the face of it, that sounds like a great thing. The problem is they are practically empty due to vaccine supply issues.
The European Commission has just launched a plan designed to detect variants of the disease earlier and share this information across the EU. The problem is that mutations are allowed to form when large numbers of people are not vaccinated.
We are ready to go one step further and to propose an emergency authorization of vaccines at EU level with shared liability among us if there's a decision by the European leaders to move in this direction.
The economic consequences for the EU of this slow vaccines rollout are almost immeasurable. The political consequences for the project might prove fatal, according to some analysts. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Iranian president says that Europe needs to take action if it wants to preserve the 2015 nuclear deal. Hassan Rouhani made the remarks in a phone call with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. He said that the agreement, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action or the JCPOA, will remain non-negotiable. The Iranian president also called for the removal of what he described as Washington's inhumane and illegal sanctions against this country. Rouhani noted that Tehran will continue to reduce its compliance with the accord if the U.S. does not lift sanctions. Merkel, for her part, voiced concern over Iran's move to scale back its JCPOA commitments. She, however, called for preserving the deal and urged dialogue to settle differences. The International Atomic Energy Agency has confirmed that its Director General, Rafael Mariano Grossi, will travel to Iran on Saturday. The visit is ahead of a deadline by Iranian lawmakers to suspend snap inspections by the UN nuclear watchdog.
Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi will visit Tehran on Saturday for discussions with senior Iranian officials in order to find a mutually agreeable solution for the IAEA to continue essential verification activities in the country.
The IAEA also touched upon Iran's plan to cease the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol to the Non-Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. The agency said that the move will have a serious impact on its verification and monitoring activities in Iran. The measure is based on a law passed by the Iranian parliament in response to the failure of the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal to fulfill their obligations. Iran says it will start implementing the legislation as of February the 23rd. Now, author and journalist Robert Fontina believes the United States should return to the Iran nuclear deal because it was Washington that unilaterally withdrew from the accord.
I think the major sticking point is that the United States doesn't want to appear weak on any possible topic. Now, the United States violated the agreement. It's up to the United States to re-enter it. By demanding that Iran do so first, it's simply hypocritical and it's simply nonsensical, because these are two parties that were in agreement. One of them violated it initially. The other one eventually stepped back from it. It's up to the one that violated it to come back to the agreement. If there's some kind of a face-saving deal that the United States wants to get from Iran so it doesn't look like it backed down, it's just unrealistic to expect that the United States must back down from the ridiculous stand that Donald Trump took by withdrawing from the JCPOA. It's simply time now to get back to international law and even U.S. domestic law, which authorized the JCPOA. U.S. domestic law never authorized its violation. It's time for Biden to come back and just reinstate it.
And with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
A new political spending analysis shows that former U.S. President Donald Trump's 2020 campaign and his joint fundraising committees paid more than $3.5 million to the individuals and firms involved in organizing the January 6th Stop the Steal rally that presaged the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stansel Ryder. This article is published under the heading Analysis Reveals Trump Operation Paid $3.5 million to Organizers of Rally That Led to Deadly Capitol Attack. Stay tuned, please. A new political spending analysis released recently shows that former President Donald Trump's 2020 campaign and his joint fundraising committees paid more than $3.5 million to the individuals and firms involved in organizing the January 6th Stop the Steal rally that presaged the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol. Investigators at Open Secrets, a project of the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics that examines how many influences U.S. elections and public policy, analyze recent Federal Election Commission FEC filings and found newly identified payments that show people involved in organizing the protest on January 6th received even larger sums from Trump's 2020 campaign than previously known. The findings come in the midst of the Senate impeachment trial that will determine whether or not Trump will be convicted for inciting the violent insurrection carried out by a mob of his supporters. Anna Masoglia, one of the campaign finance researchers who unearthed more than $3.5 million in direct payments from the then president's political operation to the January 6 organizers, wrote that there are unanswered questions about the full extent of Trump's ties to the incendiary demonstration that preceded the pro-Trump mob's invasion of the halls of Congress. Recent FEC filings show at least three individuals listed on permit records for the Washington, D.C. demonstration were on the Trump campaign's payroll through November 30, 2020. Masoglia noted, the Trump campaign paid Event Strategies Incorporation, a firm named in a permit for the rally that also employed two individuals involved in the demonstration, as recently as December 15th, just 3 weeks before the attacks on the U.S. Capitol. And yet, because the campaign used an opaque payment scheme that concealed details of hundreds of millions of dollars in spending by routing payments through shell companies where the ultimate payee is hidden, Masoglia wrote, the American public may never know the full extent of the Trump's campaign payments to organizers involved in the protest. The permit for the so-called Save America rally hosted by a pro-Trump nonprofit group called Women for America First did not explicitly allow for a march from the rally location, which was near the White House to the Capitol, Truth Out reported recently. But it does say that some participants may leave to attend rallies at the United States Capitol. Despite their attempts to distance themselves from the rally, the Associated Press reported last month that members of the Trump campaign played key roles in orchestrating the Washington rally that spawned a deadly assault on the U.S. Capitol, undercutting claims the event was brainchild of president's grassroots supporters. In a statement shared with AP, Trump's failed re-election campaign claimed that it did not organize, operate, or finance the event, and that if any former employees or independent contractors participated, they did not do so at the direction of Trump campaign. The AP's review of records, however, found evidence to the contrary. Megan Powers, whose LinkedIn profile said she was still the Trump campaign's director of operations into January 2021, was listed as one of the two operations managers for the January 6th event. And at least three of the Trump campaign aides named on the permit rushed to obscure their connections to the demonstration. According to Massagolia, demonstrating the full extent of Trump campaign's involvement in the conspiratorial demonstration that preceded the deadly attack on the Capitol is made more difficult by the rise of shell companies and politically active nonprofit channeling money from untraceable sources. She continued, Trump's 2020 campaign and joint fundraising committee, the Trump Make America Great Again Committee, spent more than $771 million through American-made media consultants, LLC, according to new data analyzed by Open Secrets. The secretive limited liability company was created by campaign aides and members of Trump's inner circle to act as a clearinghouse to pay vendors, concealing the campaign's transactions with those vendors. The FEC generally does not require campaigns to detail payments vendors make to subcontractors so long as the campaign does not have undue influence over the vendor and the subcontractor does not work under the direction or control of the campaign. But the role individuals in Trump's inner circle played in creating the limited liability company through which the campaign routed millions of dollars raises the question of whether the company is truly separate from the campaign. The former president's son-in-law and White House advisor, Jared Kushner, reportedly helped create the limited liability company, and his daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, reportedly sat on his board. The nonpartisan campaign legal center filed an FEC complaint alleging that the Trump campaign and its joint fundraising committee may have violated federal election reporting rules by laundering those funds and concealing details of the campaign's financial dealings. The role of non-profit dark money groups that do not disclose their donors in organizing the demonstrations on January 6th only adds to the opacity. Politically active non-profits are only required to report limited information about their financial dealings in tax filings more than a year after activities take place and may be able to keep their funders secret forever, Massagolia added. The lack of transparency required of such groups means many details of who they pay and who bankrolls their activities can remain hidden. Despite those limitations, the recent findings by Open Secrets of explicit financial connections between the Trump campaign and the organizers of the January 6th rally that culminated in a coup attempt corroborate the case for Trump's conviction being made by the House impeachment managers. as the House Democrats have shown, Trump told his followers for months that their victory was stolen, the election was rigged, and then a Congress prepared to testify President Joe Biden's victory on January 6th. Trump told a well-armed crowd their patriotic duty was to fight to stop the steal. As Representative Eric Swalwell said, the political spending data unearthed by Open Secrets further substantiates, as Truthout noted, the arguments of Representative Jamie Raskin, Representative Joe Negus, Dell, Stacey Plaskett, and others, that many of the events surrounding the attack on the Capitol were premeditated, and that Trump and his team knew this and egged it on. Regarding the FEC, the sole federal agency tasked with enforcing campaign finance law, Massagoglia pointed out that it was largely powerless throughout the 2020 election cycle due to a lack of commissioners. With its quorum restored, the FEC can again vote on enforcement matters addressing a backlog of complaints alleging campaign finance violations. The possibility that a failed presidential candidate's campaign may have continued bankrolling operatives behind a rally that escalated to violent insurrection raises a question of how this could have been hidden from the American public, she wrote, and raises the stakes for campaign finance transparency to a new level.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and let us present you a brief but bright gem of an advice from the Holy Prophet's 10th infallible heir, Imam Ali al-Naqi al-Hadi, peace be upon him. This life of the world is a market in which some people gained and others lost.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our regular listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the life and times of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul. And I'm your host on this program, Ejaz Hussain. Once again, I'm joined by Dr. Mahdi Torabi to give his insight on the topic of the great Satan. I'd like to say salam to him and welcome him to the program.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Mahdi Torabi, the topic of the great Satan, this was a title that was given by Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, to the U.S. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't something that was given out of emotion, given out of any, shall we say, hatred towards the Americans. This was something that was mentioned as an indication of the nature and character of what the U.S. has become in terms of this imperialistic power that seeks hegemony throughout the world.
Right.
So, Dr. Mahdi Torabi, your take, because, of course, you know, the Islamic Republic of Iran has been at the brunt of, you know, hostility of the great Satan, and for a variety of reasons, principally because you got rid of its good friend, the Shah, here in Iran, and secondly, you, the students, overtook an embassy, I remember, just a few months after the victory of the rebels.
I was very young at that time.
Yes,
I wasn't
we were. We were very young at that time and wish we had participated also in the overtake of that embassy, which was called the Den of Espionage, as I remember it. And I remember Jimmy Carter panicking on the television screens about, you know, the hostage crisis, wasn't it? You know, 444 days when the this espionage staff was, you know, held here in Iran. And, of course, that led to a lot of tensions between the Islamic Republic and the great Satan, the USA. But your take since then, and about, you know, the Imam's great insight and depth into in terms of giving, you know, this these kinds of terms for the U.S., because, of course, he wanted to make the Muslims understand that who is their real enemy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think that's good what you said in terms of, you know, making people understand who the real enemy is.
Yes.
I think at that time, okay, let's start it with this way.
Yes.
Okay. Just as a matter of principle, obviously Imam, you know, was very calculating in terms of he was very careful in what he said.
He was, yes.
He wasn't somebody who was given to, you know. And you can see the tapes and you can watch the films from back then.
When he said something, he meant it.
Right. Mm. He wasn't these people that would just, you know, come out with some statements.
Some rhetorical flourishes while he's, you know. Yeah,
He spoke quietly, calmly.
That's right.
And, you know, he was a man of 80. So,
yes, he was.
You know, he wasn't really going to get up and...
yeah, exactly.
You know, do an imitation of Mussolini or whatever, you know, or Hitler in terms of, you know...
No.
So when he says something,
yes,
there's a basis for it.
There's a wisdom in it.
Right.
Yeah.
So why would Imam use the term great Satan?
Satan, yes. I mean, that was extraordinary at the time.
Right.
I mean, it took us all aback.
For the U.S.
Yes.
And I think really it has to do with, if you read the Quran, and you are a little bit familiar with the way Shaitan
is described in
the Quran and in the Islamic sources.
Sure.
You will see Shaitan is somebody who deceives, is somebody who tries to lead people astray.
Yes. And is also very arrogant.
Right.
There were qualities here that would be described.
This is before he, if you see the first time it's mentioned, which is Baqarah.
Yes.
Surah Baqarah, when they, you know, it's the beginning of Surah Baqarah.
That's right.
When they talk about him not bowing down to Adam, Hazrat Adam.
Yes. Because he disobeyed Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Peace be upon him, in terms of, you know, Allah giving that order.
Order, yes.
That you should, you know, bow down to your...
And he became one of the mustakbirin, one of the
to the prophet and the imam of your age.
Yes, yes. Exactly. Well, there's a good point, isn't there?
Yes. And exactly. Mm. This is the point I was going to make, is that in the ayah, before it talks about him being kafir and denier of truth, he talks about him being mustakbir and takabbur and being arrogant.
Arrogant.
And remember, shaitan is a person who, or is a, you know, entity which 6,000 years, according to the Revayat, has been constantly praising and worshipping God.
Exactly. Yes.
You know, that's more than any of us.
Yeah, of course.
Right?
Yes.
6,000 years of...
That's more than a Glaswegian, because we only live till 50.
Exactly. So, you know, these are things that, you know, we should remember. Yes. When he says great Satan, he's talking about Satan and Shaitan coming from that Quranic Islamic background and that way of describing to us who Shaitan is.
Exactly.
It is a person who is arrogant. It is a person who disobeys the command of his Lord.
Sure.
It is a, you know, being that is so arrogant that it will not recognize the Imam of its age.
Exactly.
And its job is to lead people astray.
Exactly.
This is because he asked God for you know, once God decides that, you know, now that you've disobeyed, I'll have to take care of you. He says, well, give me time until the end of times.
Sure.
See how many people I can...
How much of the progeny of Adam I can destroy.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And God says, okay.
Fine. Go ahead.
Let's see what you can do.
Do, yes. Exactly.
And of course, Allah also in the Quran, in many places, talks about the people who are mukhlisin, the people who are you know, worshipping and praising Allah, you know, sincerely.
Yes.
They are immune to these.
To this entity.
Exactly. So it's not a, you know, some sort of a injustice by Allah to do this.
No.
In fact, Satan himself is a tool of Allah and does it with the permission of Allah.
Exactly.
It's not like in the Christian way of, because this is the problem we have. We when we speak about religion in English, we immediately are using the words with that baggage that comes from Christianity.
That's
in
true.
Terms of, you know, Satan having independent powers of God or being some sort of a dark force, you know.
Opposite to God.
It's
not like that.
There is no opposite to God.
No, there isn't. There's just God. Yes.
And everything happens within his plan. And part of his plan is to have an entity like the Satan.
Satan.
And we even have Shayateen talking about different
Satans.
Yes,
that's right. It's different Satans, yes.
You know, we have Iblis,
yes.
Which is, you know.
Yes. We also have our internal Satans as
right.
well.
Right. So this the ayah that I was talking about is actually referring to Iblis.
Very good.
Which is, you know, the main Shaitan.
The main Shaitan, yes.
Right?
As the U.S. is today.
Right.
Yes.
So this is the point that, you know, it's basically... And it's interesting. I think this is a very interesting subject to actually think about.
Mm.
You have, again, in the Quran, Shaitan talking about how... And the Quran describes it, how on the Day of Judgment, Shaitan will renounce all the people that he led astray. And he will say, all I did was obey my Lord.
Exactly.
So, you know.
That's right. Because he had his permission to do that in the first place. And then he says, well,
I'm not, you're not from me. I praise the Lord.
Yeah, that's right. And he said, well, they did that of their own free will. I mean, I had no power over them. I couldn't control them.
So, you know, Shaitan is a very interesting...
He is a very interesting character.
Right.
And not somebody I'd like to associate that.
Right. And I'm simply saying interesting in the sense that, you know, it's interesting to look at his place within this divine...
plan.
Within this divine structure.
Yes.
So, given all that, this was all an introduction in terms of why would
Imam Khomeini, God bless his soul, use this term. Yes, right. Exactly.
It wasn't, as you correctly pointed out, simply a rhetorical flourish or some sort of emotional...
Response to something.
Right.
Yeah.
It was a very clear statement of the nature and the essence of who we're dealing with.
Yes.
Okay. And I would add something to that, which is that a big part, or maybe the... And it's very interesting that we recently had this discussion again in the media. Americans, because of their Protestant background, because of their whole biblical way of looking at things, I'm talking about initially when America was...
That's true, yes.
Was started.
You're quite right,
and
sir.
This coming out of Britain and coming out of the different dissident movements within the Protestant movements in England.
That's correct, yes.
They have this belief that they are chosen people.
They do. You know, it's pretty much interesting how that's in line
and
with Israel.
This is something that's been discussed by academics, so this is not... I'm not saying anything new here.
No, you're not.
There's a whole set of literature on this matter that Protestants consider themselves to be the chosen people. That, you know, you had the Israelites and the Bani Israel initially, then you had, you know, the church, And then after the church, I'm talking about the Catholic Church.
That's right, yes. That's
and
right.
Once the Catholic Church went astray, then it was...
The Protestants.
Know, the burden fell onto the Protestants.
Yes, that's correct, yes.
To take on God's, you know...
I mean, this is very interesting because I've heard this a lot even in the UK, you know, right. That they do describe the US as being an apocalyptic nation in the sense that they're coming out of something right out of the Bible.
Well, what I was going to add is that yeah. Once that aspect of things, in the 20th century where you have this kind of secularization happening,
yes.
It becomes something else. It's called, they don't say we're chosen people anymore. They say we're the exceptional nation.
The exceptional nation.
Exceptionalism.
Yes,
this is exactly what Putin and Obama were arguing about. I don't know if you remember, Putin wrote,
that's right, yes.
Wrote the article.
Putin wasn't very happy about that.
And he said, you know, we don't have exceptional nations.
No.
We all, you know, ask for forgiveness from the Lord. Okay?
Yes. And we all have to make do on this planet.
Right.
Yes.
And so basically, and this is a big debate within the U.S., one of the things that the Republicans and the conservatives criticized Obama for during the first round that he was running was when they asked Obama, is America an exceptional nation? He really didn't give a very, you know, patriotic answer to that. He said, well, we're exceptional just as other nations are exceptional in their own way.
Yeah.
Gingrich had a whole book about it, how, you know, this shows that Obama is not really understanding what American civilization is and we are the exceptional nation.
Sure.
All that. We come, this is, you know, in this first term, we get to the point in Syria where he basically, the only thing he could say about why they want to bomb Syria is, and this was in the press conference, the initial press conference that he announced that he was going to do this. He said, well, in the end, we're going to do this because we're America.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
You remember?
Yes, I remember.
We're America, and America has to do these things.
America has to do this.
Right. We are the only ones that can do this. We're the ones that have this responsibility.
Yeah.
Because we're an exceptional nation.
Oh.
We're different than the others.
Mm.
Okay?
Sure.
Now, when did Imam talk about this stuff?
Oh, my goodness. We are way back.
78?
Yes.
Yes.
I think so. 78, 79, yes.
Right. So, alhamdulillah, thank God, we see the world is coming to where Imam was
years ago.
When he says that it is the great Satan, it's more than saying you are not exceptional. It is saying that by you claiming to be the exceptional nation, claiming to be the chosen people, you are arrogating something for yourself.
Self, which you do not deserve.
And which is dangerous. Which
dangerous,
leads people astray.
Yes.
Which leads people into the fire. Which leads to their destruction. Which leads to your own destruction.
Your own self-destruction as well.
And
that's
as such, we have to stand up against you.
Exactly.
We cannot be indifferent to you.
No.
Okay? This is all, you know, and I think it's good that we're talking about these things at this moment because there's all this talk again about, you know, let's have a deal with the Americans. I'm talking about in terms of, you know,
Diplomacy and other things. Yeah, that's right. Yes.
And, you know, fine. Everybody does their diplomacy.
Sure.
You know? Nobody's against diplomacy.
No.
You go, you talk, you make your points.
And you agree to disagree.
And this is the beautiful thing that, you know, the Supreme Leader always talks about, is that, you know the essence and the real identity of your enemy. This is, again, he's been talking about this in a number of speeches recently.
Point.
Where he says it's fine. He even used this the term heroic flexibility, which was a very interesting way of saying it. He said, look, you know, we talk to everyone. He used the example of a wrestler, because, you know, Iranians were wrestlers.
You have a great tradition.
We beat everyone recently.
We
had the world championships.
You have. Yes,
we beat everyone again, as usual.
As usual, yes.
We even had that meet in New York in Grand Central Station where they were invited, and we beat all the Americans in the wrestling. Okay, just for the record.
Just for the record.
Just for the record. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for
mentioning. So when the Supreme Leader uses wrestling analogies, this is something that is very, you know,
appropriate
in Iran. Everybody understands what he's talking about. And he was talking about that when a wrestler, you know, is in a clinch and is wrestling with his opponent, he might, you know, show some flexibility at times. He might let go of some area at some point, but he never forgets what he's doing.
Doing, yes.
He never forgets what the enemy is after.
After, yes.
So this is the point. I think when Imam, you know, so brilliantly and so powerfully
used this
the word
expression,
great
yes.
Satan,
yes.
He completely changed the framework in which people were looking at the United States.
Exactly.
He completely, you know, This is the great ability. This is the ability of great, you know, leaders.
Yes,
is they don't simply enter a debate; they actually shape the debate.
They shape it.
Okay, they determine the
framework parameters in of which the debate of that debate. Yes,
his thing was not, well, you know, the Americans have been unjust to us for 50 years and they overthrew.
He said
they are the great Satan. This is our starting point.
He hit the nail on the head. That's our starting point.
Is you are the great Satan.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this is, we deal with you as the great Satan. Whatever we have to do, we do. And it's interesting because, you know, even Imam then in his final testament writes about the fact that, and this is, I think, one of those, I mean, it's just, you know, sometimes he says things and you think, okay, you know, where did this guy, like, where did he come from?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, he was just amazing, some of the things he would say.
No, he was beyond time in that sense.
He said in his final testament, he said, you know, maybe there will come a time when we can be, when we can have relations with the United States if they change their attitude towards us.
Ah.
If they change their arrogance,
yes, yes.
And they change their...
That's right. He did say that.
So this is something that he's leaving the door. He's basically saying, yes, you are the great Satan, but it's because of your own behavior.
Yeah.
You can have an effect. And it's interesting. In that same sentence, he says, but we will never be friends with Ali Saud. This is very interesting. This was after they killed the
pilgrims in 1987. That's right. When they slaughtered the Hajj pilgrim pilgrims in that year.
Right.
That's
right. So, you know, this is very, to me,
interesting.
This is interesting.
Very
because
interesting.
What you have is is Imam basically saying, this is the essence and this is the identity and this is the, you know, the characteristic
of the U.S. But you may be able to have some relations with
them. This is the point about really understanding that, you know, it's all from Allah. Right?
It is.
It's not something that you know.
No, you can do from yourself. No.
Right. So we have him, you know, talking about the great Satan.
Yes.
Again, going back to the way we understand Shaitan in the Islamic sources.
Right.
And then, of course, looking at America's behavior globally.
Sure.
And isn't it interesting that these 34 years have just confirmed everything?
That's right. It's exposed America for what it is.
Isn't really America the most hated?
It is.
You know, in the nation in the world right now by other people.
Well, it's a gangster, isn't it?
Really? Isn't it something?
It's like a large Al Capone.
And remember,
you know,
what
at
time
the
Imam did this? Imam did this at a time when the U.S. was, you know, the great superpower.
Yes.
Standing up to the evil Soviets.
That's right.
To the
and
godless communists.
That's right.
Right? So, you know, America had a certain
image.
Right. They even...
Defenders of the free world.
They even, you know, had done what they did in Europe in World War II and standing up to the Nazis and standing up to, you know, the different forces that existed, which were all considered to be very good things by everybody. And and they are good things.
Yes.
Of course, it's good to stand up to, you know, a crazy person like Hitler.
Yes.
Okay? Of course, it's good to stand up to Stalinism. So these are things that, you know, America had on its, you know,
plus
resume.
Plus point on its CV. Yeah.
With all the negative stuff as well, like,
sure.
you know, all the coup d'etats and the killings and the murders in Latin America and around the world.
Yeah, the ones that they wouldn't speak about necessarily.
Right,
yes.
So before World War II, all the stuff that they did in the world, they already were practicing in Latin America. So since the Monroe Doctrine, you know, started. So this was, so it's not, we're not trying to say that it was all good or all bad, but there were elements.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, we see, you know, the first time the U.S. is seriously challenged in the Cold War.
Sure.
By a so-called third world nation, by a developing nation, is the Islamic Revolution. And, you know, isn't it beautiful that at that time, you know, it was, you know, we're neither West nor East, we're Islamic Republic.
Republic, yes.
So it wasn't like every other situation in the Cold War where if you were going to go against the U.S., you would necessarily
join
be with
the Soviet
bloc.
Yes, that's right.
Or if you were with the Soviet Union, you were necessarily against the U.S. This is the kind of world that the Americans and the Soviets wanted.
Exactly.
And they had created to
But Iran broke out of that
Iran
because of
Islam.
Iran
broke out of that complete mold. And that's why you see that...
Thanks to Imam Khomeini, God
That's why you
soul.
See the Americans and the Soviets supporting Saddam during
exactly,
the war.
Exactly,
okay? They're giving him weapons, and everybody's supporting Saddam.
They had to contain this because
right?
this was a very dangerous idea.
Right, I mean, this was like... You know, the
this
Soviets
was toxic.
And Soviets and the Americans, hey, we need to be on this. We are together on this one. Which is, you know, just think about that for a second.
I know. It was extraordinary.
And so basically what you had, and it's funny because at that time they said, well, the Soviets are the little Satan.
Okay? Yes, that's right. They're the little Satan.
Yeah. We forgot about that.
Yeah, we forgot about that.
Because the Soviets don't exist anymore. So,
yes,
you know,
that's
it doesn't
right.
matter.
So. Yeah, so that's why he was little, because he was going to resign pretty
so
soon.
This is, there's also a point in that, which is that the main enemy
is going to be the U.S.
Right. So it is in this environment that you know, our dear Imam said these things.
Sure.
He framed the debate.
Mm.
He called out the U.S. and, you know, pointed out to the real identity of the U.S. and its behavior towards others.
Sure.
Again, yeah. I repeat, when Imam talks about the great Satan, he's talking about something that's also partly in the control of the U.S. of how it behaves.
Sure.
This is not some sort of a, you know, preordained, you know.
No, it's not, no.
Where there's no influence.
Because that's very interesting that you're saying that.
Because that's not part of Islam.
Yeah, because
Everyone is capable of redemption.
Everybody, changing their behavior,
right.
That's right. So he says that if they can change their conduct, there may be some room for negotiation.
Right. Yeah. So the point is, again, the beautiful thing that he did is that from an Islamic perspective, he clearly drew the line.
Yes, he did.
Because we see, brother, look at how miserably Ikhwan failed in Egypt.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Why?
Yeah,
because
exactly.
They didn't understand who America was.
Exactly.
Okay?
Yeah.
So this is important Islamically.
That's right.
Okay? I'm talking now Islamically. We'll
yes,
go
because
step by step.
They made a fundamental mistake in their revolution.
What we saw, unfortunately, in these last years is that the Ikhwan, you know, didn't understand the nature of America.
No.
They thought that, well, we got the population to vote for us, so we'll play everyone.
Yes.
We'll deal with the Americans. We'll keep our ambassador in Israel. We'll try to, you know, be friendly with the Americans.
Yeah, try to be everything to all things.
Right.
And it all went pear-shaped. Exactly.
Why? Because from the beginning, they were not able to distinguish the reality and the identity and the essence of who...
Who is your enemy?
Who the other side is.
Yes.
What the enemy is.
Yes, sir.
Something which was very important and completely different when it came to the Islamic Revolution in Iran because of the leadership of somebody like Imam.
Yes.
And it's always Imam standing there when everybody is confused.
Yes.
And everybody's...
yeah, not so sure about what to do.
What were we supposed to do? Imam saying, this is it.
And
he was always right.
He was always right.
And this is a miracle.
This is extraordinary. Really, this is
he's not Masoom. He's a normal human being.
We've said that in a previous you've said that in a previous program, which was a very appropriate thing that you said at the time, and a very excellent point, where you said that this comes naturally out of the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt.
Exactly,
this is something expected of us,
and
if,
again,
if we follow
repeat,
it properly, that's the conclusion we'd come to.
I repeat that beautiful sentence or that phrase by Shahid Sadr.
Yes, please.
You know, Ayatollah Muhammad Baghir al-Assad,
yes,
who was martyred by, you know,
Saddam, yes,
crazy Saddam,
yes,
he tells his students, he says, you know, wubu, which is, you know, how would you melt into Imam,
yes,
become one with Imam,
Imam,
the way Imam has melted into has become one with Islam.
My God.
Okay,
what
so
a beautiful expression.
Right. So Imam is completely, you know, manifestation of all those teachings,
Mashallah.
Both in terms of the knowledge and in terms of acting on it.
Acting on it.
Yes. He's a manifestation of that.
He was the manifestation.
You know,
of
it's
that.
Interesting because we always use the word Ayatollah. He really is Ayatollah.
He was really Ayatollah. He was
because he was a sign of God.
There were books I remember that came out in the UK. You know, and it simply said the sign of God,
right.
And there was a big portrait of Imam Khomeini. There you are.
Right. So he really was Ayatollah. Because
we use
Ayatollah in terms of a title.
Yes, but he was really the Ayatollah.
But then we really have Ayatollah. And of course, all of us are Ayatollah in a certain way.
We are, but
the whole of creation is Ayatollah.
Yeah, but we're not.
But you know, he was...
Yeah.
And, you know, this is good for us to have experience because, you know, we're distant from the time of the Prophet.
Yes.
You know, when you're in the presence of a prophet or the imams, it's clear.
It's very, very clear.
I mean, it wasn't clear to everyone, but...
No. Of course, you know? I know. There were certain exceptions in
right.
those cases.
We don't
yes.
want to get to that.
We don't want to get to
but
that.
But the
yes.
point is that, you know, that presence already itself is maybe the biggest proof for a lot of people.
It is.
Just the presence of somebody
the presence,
like,
yes.
of the prophet, peace be upon him.
Yes.
Or people like Imam Ali alayhi salam or the other imams that were there. So... And you know, we're removed from that era.
Mm.
And yet we see somebody, at least for me, this was the case, I'm sure it was for you. Somebody,
yes, it
those
was.
Of us
it
who,
certainly
who,
was, sir.
Who experienced
yes.
Imam.
Thank God.
You know, thank God we lived to see him.
See that, yes. Because really we were very, very distant from any understanding of